or Lee Griffiths. Years ago, when the Open Center was just starting 8 years, 9 years ago, and just being thought about, people would ask us why we were doing it. And that's a very, not actually a very easy question to answer, because we didn't have a good answer, and so we postponed the answer and said that we were doing it to find out why we were doing it, which has a nice ring to it, and it was really true. No. Now I feel that what has happened today and culminating tonight is the answer to that question. The it started, and I'll be very brief, with my son John, who was traveling in India at the age of 20 and was introduced to the Griffiths Ashram. He stayed there for a week and it changed his life. Don't ask me how. It's like trying to summarize the Bible. There are things that you can't explain. They just are culminating, changing experiences for a transformation, what Shakespeare would call a sea change. He then became friends with Chuck Baru there, from New York City, whose friend Karen Davis then called me 2 weeks ago and said that Lee Griffiths was coming to the United States, and could I be in touch? And I definitely could. I met Chuck, and I met Lee Griffiths last Sunday, and they wanted this to happen. So the reason for the Open Center was and is to be a forum for people who travel the different path, the quiet path, the search for the inner self and the inner meaning and the interconnectedness in the world, and then at some point want and are able and are beautifully prepared to share, as Lee Griffiths has been doing for years in India, but rarely in the United States. And that's where the best of what we can do culminates. Many of you know Lee Griffiths' work, and I think a few of you actually have visited in India and know him there. So there's very little I can say that would add. For me, knowing Raimundo Panikkar, Houston Smith, and many of the luminaries who, not knowing them deeply, but knowing them through their writings and some of them personally, I feel that Bede is in that group, that rare group, that trance, that goes beyond one religion or one tradition and can see and connect and be at home in all of them and help all of us to be more comfortable and tolerant and understanding of the connectedness between all these religions and all these ways of life and help us to see them better. So with that, I thank you for coming, and I thank you very much, sir, for coming and being with us tonight.
I think if you don't you don't mind, I'll begin with a little autobiography just to put things in their setting. I've been living in this ashram, Shantivanam, South India, for the last 21 years, and people have been coming from all over the world to discover God, really, to discover a deeper meaning in their lives. It's very, they've come from all five continents, and people are in search today. And I'd like to say I've only been 3 months in the United States now, but I'm tremendously impressed with this search. I call it the search for God. You can call it the search for meaning, for truth, for reality, which is taking place everywhere. And it's a gathering movement. I met it in Germany, I met it elsewhere. But the United States, we get the impression that there really is the Spirit of God is moving among the people, you know. And it's not in only one church or one religion. It's opening itself really to humanity at large. And that's really what we're concerned with. I think we're at the end of an age. I date it, well, we can all date it from the beginning of the church in the first, second century. And it had 2,000 years now. And this has been a Greco-Roman, European, American culture. And it's done wonders. We're still living in it. But I think many of us realize that the world is moving today beyond the limits of this culture, with all its values, to another order of reality. And it's centered in the East, in Asia. And my experience, you see, has been coming from Britain originally, settling in India, opening on a totally new world. And I think we as Christians, particularly those of us who are Christians or Catholics, have got to realize that we're living in a comparatively small world. I think two-thirds of humanity lives in Asia. I'm not sure of the exact figures. But it's not only the numbers, it's another culture altogether, another understanding of human existence. Come along, can you all find seats? Come across to that, you'll find one. There's another one here. Someone like? Oh.
No.
So I was just saying, you see, that in our ashram in Shantivanam, where we come from Britain, we come from the West, we come from the Catholic tradition, and from the beginning it's tried to open up to the Oriental tradition. And this is the challenge which is facing America, Europe, the whole Western world today. How do we relate to this culture of Asia with its profound religious traditions, Hindu, Buddhist, Jain, Sikh, then the Taoist, the Confucian, the Chinese, all these traditions are there. And so far, the Christian churches have hardly encountered them. We've gone out with our missions to give our version of Christianity, but we've not really asked ourselves, what do these people, how would they understand Christ and Christianity? And that is where the future lies. You see, the church's day is moving out of the European tradition with its center in Rome and in Canterbury and Germany and so on, and America, and is opening up to the wisdom of the East. And personally, when I was quite young in the 20s, I read three books which have permanently influenced my life. They were in the Wisdom of the East series, The Dhammapada of the Buddha, The Tao Te Ching of Lao Tzu, and the Bhagavad Gita. And those three are three classics of Oriental wisdom which have a profound meaning and value for all humanity. And we must realize they don't belong to Hinduism or Buddhism or any limited religion. They are scriptures of humanity. You may be interested, I have a great friend in Germany, Roland Ropers, who is in the publishing business, and we're planning together to produce within the year a book of readings from the scriptures of the world, to be from Hinduism, Buddhism, Sikhism, Taoism and Confucianism, Islam, Judaism and Christianity. And I think today we've got to learn to live our religion, and we can live it authentically as Christians or whatever we are, but in this openness to the other traditions of the world. That's the challenge today. No religion today can remain isolated. We're realizing we're members of one another, and most of us believe there is a divine plan in this. God has been at work throughout human history. I always like to remind people, you know, the Australian Aborigines have been in Australia for 40,000 years. And it's the last 100 years they've heard of Jesus, perhaps, in the Christian church. But for 39,000 years, they've been living in the presence of God. There's a wonderful religion, like among the American Indians, the Australian Aborigines have this sense of the presence of God. And however far back you go, you get this profound sense God is in the earth, in the water, in the air, in the fire, in the whole world around you. And actually that, you know, is one of the great attractions of India. I know many of you have been there, find it. You immediately counter this sense of the sacred. And we tend to lose it. We want to master the world, to control it, and to manage it. But the ancient people, they were part of this cosmic whole. And they had the sense of the sacred. I'm sure Chuck and others will say, wherever you go in India, you feel that sense that the earth is sacred. Take a very simple thing. When you have a meal, typically you take a plantain leaf, a banana leaf, you don't use plates or anything, and you put your rice on it, and then you put some vegetables around it, and then you take some water, and you pour the water around it to make a sacred space. Your meal is something sacred. Mother Earth has given you these gifts, and you're now going to offer them in the fire of your stomach to the Lord. And we always chant a grace from the Bhagavad Gita. I, the Lord, seated in the body, consume the four kinds of food. We offer our food as a sacrifice to the Lord within, and he accepts our offering. We unite ourselves with the cosmos and with God. And every meal should be a sacrifice like that, a sacred thing. And it's to learn the sacredness of the world, of life, of the whole of humanity. And this is where we're moving today, you see. And it's so important that in each religion we learn we don't have to renounce our own religion. You don't have to become a Buddhist or a Hindu. You can remain authentically a Christian, and if you're Catholic, you can remain an authentic Catholic. But you have to be open now to the traditional wisdom, whether it's the Australian Aborigines, the American Indians, African tribal people, whatever, and of course to the Hindu, the Buddhist, the Muslim, the Sikh, and the other great religious traditions. And unless we're prepared to do that, we're going to remain cut off, you know, from the mainstream of humanity, and we're going to become more and more centers of conflict. You see, religions today are sources of conflict in the world, whether it's Hindus and Muslims or Jews and Muslims or Catholics and Protestants in Ireland, wherever you go, always religion is a source of conflict because we each believe we have the one truth. And it's good in a way. Each religion is convinced, a Muslim is just as convinced as a Christian, that the one divine truth was revealed to Muhammad through the Archangel Gabriel and is contained in the Quran. And that is the truth for him. There's no other. And so you begin to conflict with the others. And we've got to learn that God is revealing himself in many ways. And each of us has a unique gift from God. And if we're a Christian, we have a unique revelation from God in Christ. And that's a precious gift which we want to live and we want to share. But we have to realize that God has given other gifts to other people. And they are called to share with us. We had a meeting at Shantivanam in our ashram years ago. And Monsignor Rossano, who was then secretary of the Secretariat for Non-Christians in Rome, he came, and there was a bishop there and other important people. And I always remember his speech where he said, we come to share one another's spiritual riches. And that is how we look at it today. We have the riches of Christ to share with others, and we must be prepared to share the riches which they have to share with us. Another reminiscence, if you don't mind, I once had an interfaith group in Trivandrum in Kerala, and a group of us Christians went there, and it was a Hindu ashram, and they were all a little nervous about what we were going to do. They're always afraid we're just out to convert them, and we had to make it clear, you see, and we said, when once we said we come to share with one another, It was wonderful, and everybody opened up. And we would take a theme like, say, creation, salvation, grace, prayer. And what do I as a Christian, how do I understand it? How does he as a Hindu understand it? How does he as a Muslim understand it? Then the religions come alive, and we begin to interrelate. See, it's this question of interrelationship. And this is now another aspect is dawning, that many of you may be familiar. The whole movement in Western science today is undergoing a revolution, really. They call it a new paradigm, a paradigm shift. I came in contact when I read Frithjof Capra's book, The Tao of Physics, many of you will know it, and I went to a conference in Bombay, and not 5 years ago, I think it was, of Western scientists and psychologists, mostly from America, and Eastern thinkers. The Dalai Lama was there, Mother Teresa was there, Swami Muktananda, I think, and others. And it was a meeting of Western science and Eastern mysticism, if you like. And that is what is happening today, you see. Western science is undergoing a profound revolution, really, is through relativity and quantum theory particularly. But what has happened is that the Newtonian world of solid bodies moving in space and time, everybody separated and divided, has broken down, and the scientist today sees the universe, as Capra describes, as a complicated web of interdependent relationships. We're living in a world where everything is interdependent, and we share the earth and the sky and the sun and the moon and the stars and the animals and the plants. It's all part of one world, and we're all members of this one world. And then as human beings, we arrive very late on the scene, but we form a community within this vast community of the world, and we have to learn to share with one another. You see, one of the things that has come about through modern communications and so on, we're able to reach to all parts of the world. We're discovering this global unity. It's tremendous impact it has. We've all been living in such a small world, whether whatever religion or race or culture we belong to, and now we're beginning to see what it is to belong to humanity and how humanity belongs to this cosmic whole. One of the books which impressed me so much since I've been here is Father Thomas Berry's Dream of the Earth. I don't know whether many of you know it. I think it's a wonderful book. You see, we've had very little sense of our communion with the earth. We think of the earth and the whole created world as something below us, which we've got to control, manipulate, and manage, and so on. And we've lost a sense that it's a cosmic whole. It is a living whole. And you'll be surprised in the ancient world how they were always aware that the universe is a living whole. They called it the anima mundi, the soul of the world. And we're living in communion with the earth and the stars and the sun and the moon and with the trees and the plants and the animals and with our fellow human beings. It's this cosmic vision. And you see, science and mysticism, the two extremes, I say America and India, are meeting now. And the scientist today realizes that you cannot understand any part of the universe except in the context of the whole. The old idea was if you pulled it to pieces, got to know all the parts, the atoms and so on, you would understand the whole thing. And now they realize that you cannot understand a single, you can't understand an electron and how it behaves unless you understand it in the context of the whole cosmos. And so scientific vision, and Thomas Berry has this wonderful vision, hasn't he, of the wholeness of the whole creation. And our participation in this life of creation, the life of the universe. Then another person I met a few days ago is Father Matthew Fox. I think he's spoken at this center. And he's a Catholic theologian who's got a broad vision on the same lines. He's in touch with the scientific movement, particularly through Brian Swim, who teaches at his institute. And he's in touch with all these movements which are coming to birth now in religious circles, the awakening of the mystical tradition. And what I have discovered in America is precisely the extraordinary flowering which is taking place of contemplative life, of mystical understanding. And to me, this is the key, you know, which we all have to find. There are three levels of reality. The physical level, the psychological level, and the spiritual level. And the physical level, we have a body, a physical organism. It's part of the physical organism, the universe. And we have to realize we're members of this cosmic whole. Our bodies have the same vibrations of atoms and electrons and things, which started 15,000 million years ago when the cosmos exploded. We're all part of that cosmic explosion in our bodies. And then we have a psychological universe, our psyche, and we must distinguish, as Christians, Catholics particularly, are very slow to do so, between the psyche and the pneuma, the soul and the spirit. They're not the same, they're quite different. The soul, the psyche, is a psychological organism with its appetites, its senses, its feelings, imagination, reason and will. All those belong to the psyche. And in the Hindu tradition, that is called Prakriti, that is nature. And nature, Prakriti, is quite distinct from Purusha, who is spirit, who is that which is beyond. So we have this psychological organism, and we belong to the psychological organism of the universe. And each of us in our unconscious is linked with the unconscious of humanity from the beginning. You know, the fathers of the church had a very profound view in that. They spoke of Adam, this man, or man-woman, if you like, if it's not male, how he is present in all men and all women. The whole humanity is one human being, really. And St. Thomas Aquinas, who's the great authority for the church, said, omnes homines unus homo. All men and women are all one man-woman. We're all one, you see, members of a whole. And so, psychologically, we're all members of one another, from the Australian Aborigines, the American Indians, the African tribal people, and the most sophisticated people in America or Europe. We all form one human community. And that is on the psychological level. But now, this is the real key, beyond the body, the soma, beyond the soul, the psyche, that is the pneuma or the atman in Sanskrit. And that is what Karl Rahner called the point of human self-transcendence. At the point of the soul, if you like, the fine point of the soul, as Francis of Sales called it, we are open to the infinite, to the eternal, to the divine. And every human being in the depths of his being has a point where he's open to God. I've been talking with people quite frequently, even at supper this evening, the way children, you know, have extraordinary intimations of this reality beyond their ordinary life. Children of 2 or 3 years old and 5 and 6 have wonderful intuitions of the presence of angels. Now, we think there are no angels, but, you know, the ancient world realized behind the physical, it's always a psychological. You can't separate soul and body, psyche and soma. And they always recognize these spiritual presences in the cosmos. That's what you see in the sense of the sacred in India, you see. Behind all the physical phenomena and psychological phenomena, there are the gods, the angels, the powers, the spirits, you see. And their presences. And those who are sensitive are aware of these presences. And children are often acutely aware of this presence, you see. I was telling some friends at supper, a story was told me about a small boy of about 6 who fell from a 10-story building or something and landed without much damage to himself. And his mother asked him, "What happened, Michael?" And he said, "Well, I said to God, please catch me." And he said, "Sorry, Mike, I can't catch you, but I'll give you a soft landing." It's incredible, you know. They've got that sense. There is that power there all the time. We were not aware of it. So to a way, you see, I think today in America and elsewhere, people are awakening to this transcendence beyond the physical and the psychological with all its elaborations and all that science and psychology can tell us. Is this transcendent mystery, the It must know name for it. That is the difficulty. You can call it God, you can call it Tao, you can call it Brahman, you can call it so many different names, but it has no name and no form. And that is why it's difficult. And when we begin to talk about it, we have to give it a name and to talk about it. But it's something that is drawing us beyond ourselves, beyond our limits, and beyond the limits of every religion. We're being drawn to the source of all, the one, the true, you see. And that is where humanity is being led from the beginning, and where we're being consciously led today. I think people in America today are awakening to this drawing to something beyond our present world. And now there's a very important point here. In India and the East, the tendency has been, they've awoken to this. You see, in the Upanishads, in the 5th, 6th century before Christ, there was a tremendous awakening to this transcendent mystery. They called it Brahman, that's when the universe, and Atman. When you look around the universe, you see behind all the outward forms and all the inner forms, the gods and the powers, they recognize the one supreme power, the Brahman, present everywhere in everything. And then they looked into themselves, beyond the body, beyond the mind, beyond all your thoughts and feelings, is your Atman, your spirit, the inner self. And the Atman and the Brahman are one. When you get beyond all forms of nature and the world around you to their source, you find that your source of your being, of your consciousness, is one with the source of the whole universe. At the depths of our being, we're one with the eternal truth, the eternal reality. And it's in all of us, if we can realize it. See? And so, India had this experience in the 5th, 6th century, and the Buddha had it. The Buddha saw through whole. It's a negative approach. The Hindu was positive. They saw the Brahman Atman behind everybody and everything. Buddha simply analyzed the outer world, and he saw everything was negative. All is anicca, without its temporary, it's not eternal. Everything is passing away all the time, impermanent, you see. And everything is dukkha. And that means not merely sorrow, it means there's suffering, there's unsatisfactoriness in life. Whatever we go after, we always meet with some dissatisfaction. The world is not satisfactory. And the third is unutter. Nothing has substance in itself. The whole universe, and modern science bears it out, is a stream of energy, flowing and flowing and changing all the time. There's no substance there. There's nothing you can hold on to. But once you let go of the world around you and all the changing things, you discover nirvana. You discover the eternal reality, which is joy, which is peace, which is love, which is compassion. And the Buddha realized that compassion. So this was the breakthrough in India in the 5th, 6th century. And I think we've all got to go back to that. And for those who are interested, in the Penguin Classics, Mascaro, who is a professor in Cambridge, he's dead now, translated the Upanishad and the Bhagavad Gita in excellent English in the Penguin Classics. And he also translated the Dhammapada, the Buddha, which is perhaps the best early Buddhist text we have. So anybody who wants can make contact with this breakthrough in India in the 5th, 6th century. But now the problem is this, that the breakthrough was so profound, they went beyond all created being, that they tended to lose contact with the world around them. And more it was seen as Maya, as a kind of illusion. There's a certain truth in it, it is. It's all passing away all the time, but it has its reality. And we have to recognize the reality of the world. And the danger in India has been, as I say, to dismiss the world of appearances, of sense and feeling, and even the personal God as something which passes away, and to focus on the one eternal, infinite, unchanging reality, you see, the Brahman. But it's too one-sided. And today we're being challenged, you see, to go beyond the present. And I think here in America, you have to try to go beyond all the world of the senses. Everything in America, it's incredible what you've achieved. It's a wonderful life. But it's all passing away, and there's no finality there. And you've got to go beyond all that. And then, but when you go beyond, you've got to return. Now, this is, I think, one of the, Mr. Walter Beebe was saying, we're moving into something new. And I think where we're moving today is, it's not enough to go beyond the present world, to a God beyond, to heaven above and so on. You see, that's only one half the truth. When we've gone beyond, we've got to return and discover how that one reality is in everybody, in everything. And that is where I think we're moving today. We have to try to combine this sense of transcendence, the God who is beyond all, and who is also within all. And this comes out beautifully in one of the earliest and most important Upanishads, the Isha Upanishad. And it has a very remarkable state. First of all, it begins by saying, all this world, moving and unmoving, is pervaded by the Lord. And that is fundamental. The whole creation, every blade of grass and grain of sand, is pervaded by the Lord. He's present everywhere. And therefore, and then it says, therefore, renounce and enjoy. You've got to renounce attachment to this world, to the things that you enjoy and so on. Enjoy, but in, when you renounce your attachment, you can enjoy them. You've not got to get rid of them at all, but be detached from food and clothing and sex and marriage and children and good, all the good things of life. You can have them all, provide you don't cling to them. And for the Buddhists, you know, tanha, clinging, is the great sin. You cling to your children, your wife, or your goods, or whatever it is, and they hold you. Let go of all these things, then you can enjoy them. There's a beautiful poem of Blake, many of you I know, he who bends to himself a joy does the winged life destroy. If you try to catch things all the time, you destroy them, your pleasure goes. But he who catches joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. You can have everything as long as you don't sing. Let it come and let it go. And that is seeing the eternal in time, the infinite in space, you see. And so we're being challenged today, as I say, to go beyond everything and to return. Many of you will know the ox pictures about the man who's in search of truth, of nirvana, and he sees a footprints of an ox. And he goes in search of it, and he sees the ox in the distance, and he comes up to it, and he catches it by the tail, and then he gets up level with it, and he jumps onto it, and finally rides off, and the last picture is a void. He goes into the emptiness, the void, the nothingness, the nirvana. And then the last picture, he comes back to the marketplace. And that is what we have to do. You've got to go beyond everybody and everything until you reach the utter emptiness, non-being, the non-duality, actually. And then you have to return. You've got to find that infinite holy mystery in yourself, in the people around you, in the suffering of people. And this is very important, you see. More and more you discover that God, the infinite, is in the suffering of the world. And today it's one of the graces, you know, of the present world. We are very conscious of the handicapped and humiliated, children, weak people, women who are discriminated against. We've got this sense of concern now. And we realize that it's only when we realize the presence of God in all these people, in every situation, in the worst situation that there is, that we really discover the meaning. And that, of course, the meaning of the crucifixion, you know. See, Jesus had lost everything. He'd been abandoned by his disciples and his whole Jewish community had rejected him and so on. And there he was hanging on the cross, given up everything. And you know, the last thing he had to give up was his God. My God, why have you forsaken me? It's tremendous, you know. And that meant he'd still got an image of God, a concept, a projection. We project these images and concepts. He had to renounce every created concept that was possible, you see. And at that moment when he surrendered totally, he became totally one with the eternal, with the truth, with God, with love, you see. And that is the great mystery. But he'd given up everything. in order to reach that total self-surrender. And that's a model of self-surrender. So, as I was saying, we have to go beyond everything and then return and discover how this mystery of God, of grace, of truth, which is ultimately the mystery of love, is present everywhere, in every situation, and where things are at their worst, you know. People like Mother Teresa have discovered that, you know, going into the slums of Calcutta and picking up the people in the streets and so on, totally abandoned, totally helpless and hopeless, and giving them life and hope. I always remember one story, rather typical. They picked up an old man from the street, and he was eaten up with maggots, you know. He was dying in the street there. And they had to wash him and clean him. He was stinking, of course. A horrible sight. And they cleaned him up and put him to bed and nursed him and so on. I think in about an hour he died. And his last words were, "I'm going to God." You see, if you care for a person like that, you wake them to the reality behind all this. And people dying in the streets can be very, very near to God, you know. And the very poor people in the villages in India, you think they're hopeless, living like animals, they've got a wonderful sense, you know, of the presence of God in their lives. And that's what sustains them. They're a judgment on us, you know, very often. People often go from our ashram down to the village, the Harijans, as we call them, the outcasts, and they're desperately poor, but they've got this sense of God in their lives, you know. It's tremendous. And it gives them such a joy. There's something there. Everybody notices they've got something which we tend to lose, you see. So this is the return to the marketplace, you see, rediscovering this truth. And so these are the steps which I think we're being called upon to follow today. You see, first of all, we don't have to give up our own religion. You see, many Christians begin to think, oh, I must become a Buddhist or a Hindu or whatever. But they are discovering today that you can remain a perfectly faithful Christian and Catholic and do all that is required while you open your heart and your mind to the values and the truth in other religions. And happily, after the Vatican Council, the Catholic Church has accepted this as a principle, you see. It says the Church rejects nothing that is true and holy in other religions, and Catholics should recognize, preserve, and promote the spiritual and moral values as well as the cultural and social values of other religions. So in principle, we're totally open to all religious values, you see. And we're learning the way of dialogue. Mission today is dialogue. In the old days, we thought we'd just go and preach the gospel, convert people. And it's been an almost total failure. I don't know whether you realize it. We've had missionaries in Asia for 500 years, from Francis Xavier and great saints and holy people, and they've done wonderful work, and they've converted hardly 1% of the people of Asia after 500 years. Not because they don't want Christ, they do, but they don't want Christ in European clothing. And we've been giving a European Christ to them, a European culture. And they're looking for Christ in their own clothing, in their own culture. And that is the mission of the Church today, is mission through dialogue. You meet the Hindu, the Buddhist, the Jain, the Sikh, whatever, and you must share with them, listen to them. I had a good experience when I first came to India. We got a little bungalow outside Bangalore, and Hindu students began coming up out of curiosity, see what we were like. And we had a lot of Hindu books, the Upanishad, the Gita, and other things. And they were delighted. They'd said they'd never found this in any other Christian institution. Probably they'd not been very far. But it meant so much to them, you see, that we knew much more about the Upanishad and the Gita than they did. But they recognized, we were recognizing their religion. And spontaneously, they began to ask about Christ. One of them asked for a life of Christ, and so on. You share. Once you open to the other, listen to him, he opens to you and is ready to listen to you. But if you try to put it across without listening, they just reject you totally. The Hindus hate Christians who try to convert them like that. But Christians who come to them in love and mutual understanding, they're totally open. And that's how we have to learn. Mission through dialogue, this way, and through inculturation. That's the other word we use now. Dialogue and inculturation, to express and live our Christian faith in the context of Eastern or Indian or Chinese culture not in the context of European Western culture. And that's what our founders did in our ashram, you see. They were two very holy men, Hugh Moshana and Henri Lassau, who took the name Abhishekdananda, some of you may know his writings. They came to India in the 1940s, and they started this ashram in 1950, and their precise object was to live a totally Christian life and a contemplative life according to the tradition of the church in the context of Indian culture, where this kavi we wear, this is a sacred color in India. For any Hindu or Buddhist for that matter, anybody who wears a kavi is renounced the world to seek for God. That's what it means, you're in search of God. And it's therefore sacred to them, the kavi color. So they took that, and then they began to go barefoot. I don't wear shoes or socks when I'm in India. We go barefoot. And you know, in any sacred place in India, you take off your shoes, like Moses before the burning bush. Take the shoes from off your feet, for this is holy ground. So you take off your shoes as a sign of your humility, your freedom from all these extravagances, extra things. You see, you go naked before God. It's the real calling. And so, but you know, when I first came to India, there was a rule in the church that every priest must wear shoes and socks when he celebrates Mass. That's where we were. Now we've changed what it is. So inculturation means living a Christian life in the context of Indian culture. It may be Hindu, it may be Muslim or Sikh or Jain, whatever. But there is a common culture, you know, in India, and all religions respect it. And so we try to live that. And then to express our Christian faith in Indian terms, and that is much more difficult. But we must realize, you know, we express our Christian faith in Greco-Roman terms. Almost all you see the language, the Trinity, that's a Latin word, is a translation of trias in Greek. And incarnation, that's the Latin incarnatio, and it's another Latin translation of the Greek. Everything is Latin and Greek, you see. All our structures, all our theology, all our liturgy, all our canon law, it's a Greco-Roman structure built on the message of Jesus and the apostles, with the presence of the Holy Spirit, no doubt, but in a Western structure. And today we're learning, we've got to free ourselves from the Western structure, express our Christian faith in the language of Vedanta, of Mahayana Buddhism, of Taoism, and of Sufism among the Muslims. And there we have a universal mystical tradition which runs through all the religions. I wrote a book, some of you may know of it, called The New Vision of Reality. It came out last year. And I pointed out there there's a figure which is found in all the four great religions of the universal man. And in the Christian tradition, it's the Son of Man. The one the term in which Jesus seemed to speak of himself normally was the Son of Man. The Son of Man has come, you see. And that means the one who is one with humanity and who unites humanity with God. This is the universal man. And in Hinduism, he's called Purusha. And that Purusha means a man, actually. And that man is said to be one-fourth on earth and three-quarters in heaven. He belongs to this world and he shares this world, but he's beyond it all. He transcends it all. He's transcendent and immanent. And then in the Buddhist tradition, the Mahayana, you see the Hinayana, the early tradition of Sri Lanka and Burma and Thailand, who is a rather limited form of Buddhism. It's very valuable in its way. The Mahayana.